I'm delighted to welcome you to the second seminar series from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. I'm delighted to see such a good turnout. Many of you will be very familiar with Jenny Coppey's work. She's pioneered, I think, the interest and the importance of lay knowledge within the health service, and has been central in getting medics and others to take lay knowledge as an important factor in thinking about the etiology of health and illness. She's been a long time researcher and activist in public health, and started out life in Peter Draper's unit in looking at the study of health policy. She's made many friends in Glasgow, she tells me, and she's pleased to be here. We're delighted to welcome her. She's currently Professor of Sociology and Public Health at Lancaster University, and she's going to speak to us today on the contribution of lay knowledge to reducing health inequalities. So can we have a warm welcome to Jenny Coppey.
Thanks very much. Can you hear me all right? I've got this microphone on. I came in here feeling really confident, actually, and as the faces that I recognise have increased in number, I'm thinking, oh, God. So a number of people here will have heard the same jokes, even 20 years ago, actually, because I've got a few core jokes, well, maybe only one joke, actually, that I know a couple of people will remember. And some of you will remember the last time I spent any time in Glasgow was when I had the pleasure of the only time I was mentioned in Hansard, actually, which is when Margaret Thatcher used me as an excuse for doing research on unemployment and health. So my memories of Glasgow are mixed, actually. Anyway, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm going to talk about where's the evidence, the contribution of lay knowledge to reducing health inequalities. And there's three questions I'm going to try and answer. Given that I set them for myself, I should be able to answer them, but you'll be the judge of that. The first is, I wanted to just talk about what I mean by lay knowledge, just in case we've got many different understandings of that, so you understand where I'm coming from. And then talk about how I think it can inform action to reduce health inequalities. And then comment on why it isn't taken more seriously. Now, I'm not going to be presumptuous and say that it isn't taken seriously in Scotland. It may very well be taken very seriously in Scotland. So this is a particularly English perspective where I'm absolutely convinced it isn't taken seriously, and you can form your own judgment about how Scotland performs. So what is lay knowledge? The first thing to say about it, this is a very speedy computer. I wanted to start with this quote, really, which is from one of the books that's had an enormous impact on me, called The Classic Slum, written by Robert Roberts, about Salford, which is where I was born, and where Marx and Engels wrote their Das Kapital. And he wrote about his life in Salford as the son of a shop owner. And right at the beginning of the book, I think he has this wonderful quote, which for me kind of encapsulates what lay knowledge is about. He says, "This is a book made much from talk, the talk first of men and women 50 or more years ago, of ideas and views repeated in families, streets, factories and shop, and born in mind with intent. Many amongst them shrewd and thoughtful could not only recapitulate experience, they knew how to assess its value in relation to their lives." So I've underlined there the issue of lay knowledge as being talk, and I'll come back to that. It is about experience. It is people describing their experience. But for me, a key issue is about it being evaluation. So let me say a little bit more about that. The three key issues, I think, that are determine the utility of lay knowledge from a health inequality perspective, but also generate some of the core problems with lay knowledge, are the first, that it is empirical. It's an empirical approach to understanding, explaining, and assigning meaning to everyday life. And that issue of meaning is absolutely critical to its value, really. But it comes in the form of stories. It's presented in narrative form. And it's not them that have stories and we professionals that don't have stories. All of us talk about everyday life in story form. So wherever you spend your leisure time, the pub, the wine bar, the club, if you think about what you do when you're sitting around a table talking to friends, you're often telling stories. So everyday life is captured in stories, and that's where we find lay knowledge. And the third characteristic, which is really important, is that it is subjective. It's about me, my life, my experiences. And that is in sharp contrast to the objectivity that is at least claimed for professional knowledge, for research-based knowledge. So flowing from that come some problems. And perhaps the most important of these is the difference between the kinds of questions that public health science and public health practice-based knowledge seeks to answer, and the kinds of questions that lay knowledge seeks to answer. So what science is about is lots of things, but at its core from public health is about causality. What causes this particular problem? What do we know about the causes of coronary heart disease? What do we know about the causes of health inequality? What do we know about the effectiveness of this intervention? Whereas for lay people, for those of us, all of us, when we are operating as lay people, the questions we're much more interested in is why me? Why is this happening to me? And why is this happening to me now? And there's a very lovely piece of research on childhood leukemia, which I think illustrates this really powerfully. What the researchers found was this constant tension and frustration between the professionals caring for children with leukemia and the parents. And at the heart of that frustration was the fact that the professionals were working really hard to explain why this child had leukemia in terms of causality. What was leukemia? And what the parents wanted to know was, why is it our child? And why is it our child now? And underpinning that was, have we done something wrong? Are we to blame for our child having leukemia? So there's a moral issue in relation to lay knowledge, which is really important. So from a scientific perspective, and this is potentially a gross simplification, but you can still find many examples of this, lay knowledge is generally viewed as a kind of primitive remnant of a bygone time. And even the language reflects that. When you think, if you still read texts for health professionals, it talks about lay beliefs, and it always links it to culture. As if it's something that we've brought with us from our past, before we were in a rational age of science, really. And historically, lay knowledge has been studied in order to understand what broadly non-compliant behaviour. Whether that's, why don't these buggers take their pills? And why don't they take their pills when we tell them to take their pills? Or why do they carry on smoking? And why are they all eating such rubbish? So, and if you look through the literature, there's a lot of qualitative research that has been done in order to unpick this apparently illogical, health-damaging behaviour. Now, alongside that, there's a growing literature that's recognising the sophistication of lay knowledge and the fact that if we take it more seriously, it's a form of expertise from which we can learn a great deal. So let's look at the second question, really. How can lay knowledge inform action to reduce health inequalities? And I wanted to comment briefly on three areas, really, that I think are important. The first two very briefly, the third one in a little bit more depth. But certainly in England, there is now a recognition that health services and public services in general, but health services in particular, have got a really important contribution to make to reducing health inequalities and promoting health. That's in contrast to, I suppose, maybe just 10 years ago, when health services were seen to be not relevant to the health inequalities agenda. So there, from a health inequality perspective, there is a quality of care issue, an issue about the appropriateness of care, the accessibility of care, and the clinical quality of care. There's a key issue in relation to individual behaviour, and certainly our current white paper is almost entirely focused on changing individual behaviour. And then there's the agenda around the wider determinants of health inequality. So what about improving quality of care? There's two different stories here. The first is around lay people being involved in treatment decisions, and the second is about collective involvement, the collective voice. And I just want to give you some brief kind of ideas of where the issue of lay knowledge is increasingly important in relation to quality of care. So on the individual treatment side, there has been a rethinking of the notion of non-compliance. And the reason for this rethinking of the notion of non-compliance, underlying it, is that people have understood the lay knowledge issue in relation to behaviour for medication. And what the research on lay knowledge is showing us is that people, all of us, will use medication as a resource. So we will make our own decisions about when to take the pill. We will, if we're taking a cocktail of pills, as many older people are, they get a side effect. They'll reduce one of the pills and see whether it has an effect on the swelling in the ankles. Or they'll increase another one to see if it stops the headaches. So they're doing their own fine calculations about how these drugs affect their bodies. And they will do it. There is no way that you will stop them from doing it. And doctors do it as well. It's a very interesting study of doctors fiddling around with drugs they don't understand, apparently. So if we think about this issue of compliance as medication, as a resource for patients, then there's a different kind of dynamic set up in terms of the kind of knowledge exchange that goes on between an individual clinician and a layperson. The second area is the recognition of expert patients. We have a program in England called the Expert Patient Program. I don't know whether it's found its way to Scotland. And I find this really problematic, the notion that we need expert patients, in the same way as maybe we need to have a program for expert health professionals. Because it's quite clear from the research that we already have expert patients. And the evaluation of the expert patient program is beginning to show that it's de-skilling people. And the classic example of that, of course, is people with AIDS HIV, who frequently are more expert than their healthcare provider. But there are many examples around people with particular long-term conditions who already have expertise. And the response of the healthcare system is assuming that you have to teach them to become experts rather than listening and recognizing their expertise. And then the third area is this notion of collaborative decision making. And there is some research that shows that if decisions about what treatment if decisions about treatment are taken collaboratively between clinicians and individual patients, then the health outcomes are better. Okay? So there's absolutely no doubt now, I think there's a large body of research that shows that if individual clinical behaviour is influenced strongly by the lay expert knowledge, then we will get better care and we will get better outcomes. On the collective side, that's the idea that groups of people who use services, groups of people will act together to shape the services. And originally, of course, that was a struggle. And one of the earliest examples of that struggle was parents of young children not being allowed to stay in hospital with their children. And it was mothers, in fact, that started a movement to force the healthcare system to begin to create environments where mothers could stay in hospital with children. The mental health service transformed by the collective voice of mental health survivors. And now, around the globe, increasing examples where groups of people take control of the services. And the classic ones are the Aboriginal and Torres Islanders in Australia who are running their own community health services and having phenomenal results in terms of health outcomes. So the changes that they make to services are based on their experiential lay knowledge. It is a way of transforming care that means that care will be more appropriate, more accessible, and as a result, you will get better outcomes from the care. So what about the second one, better understanding of behaviour? There is now, as I said, in the UK, a dominant focus on health-damaging behaviour. The white paper is almost entirely about individual behaviour. There's a little bit on communities leading for health, but the thrust is about stopping these buggers from damaging themselves one way or the other. And there is in there a sense that the problem is primarily about lack of knowledge. Okay, And I believe very strongly that the reason we get ourselves in that pickle is because we don't really understand the meaning of the behaviour in question, the meaning of dietary behaviours that are causing problems, the meaning of smoking in people's lives. And the classic example of research that has really illuminated that is Hilary Graham's work on poor women and smoking, where she did quantitative work which shows that the poorer women are, the more likely they are to smoke and the more they smoke. The more children they have, the more likely they are to smoke and the more they will smoke. And the poorer the health of their children, the more they smoke and the more likely they are to smoke and the more they smoke. But what the qualitative research that she did showed was the meaning of smoking in those women's lives. And she used the notion of coping to explain that by talking to women about when they smoked. And all the women she spoke to recounted the story of stressful situations where the kids were driving them mad, they were at the end of their tether, and what they did was go out of the room, close the door, have a cup of coffee and a fag. And that cigarette was a really important part of the mechanism that they used to cope. So if you remove the cigarette in that situation without changing the situation where they need to cope, they'll find something else to do. So what we need is a much more sophisticated understanding about the meanings of these behaviours that we're trying to change. And I think, from my experience, we don't come at these behaviours initially by thinking about meaning. We come at it through from a lot of different perspectives, but not from meaning. So what about the wider determinants of health inequality? There are, in fact, many examples of how lay knowledge can make a really valuable contribution to action to reduce health inequalities in terms of the wider determinants. I think, for example, there are increasing examples where lay people have identified the causes of health problems before the professions. Asbestosis, for example, there was a really interesting historical study looking at widows of men who had died of asbestosis. Over 20 or 30 years giving evidence to tribunals about the fact that it was what the men had breathed in that was killing them. But it took 20 or 30 years before anybody took any notice. Similarly, women who took medication to stop premature miscarriage, some 20 years of them saying that this was causing ovarian cancer in their female children. More than two decades before professional researchers heard what they were saying and tested the association. There are many, many examples of the power of listening to what lay people have to say about the causes of health problems. But what I wanted to talk about was something a bit different than that, which is a piece of research that I've done with others into the nature and significance of theories, lay theories, about the causes of health inequalities. And this was a study that was conducted in Salford in Greater Manchester and Lancaster. And we had four neighbourhoods, a bit like the work that the Mark Pettigrew, Sally McIntyre's unit have got going in Glasgow, only it was shorter duration. So in each of those cities we had a high-income area and a low-income area, and we did surveys and qualitative research. And I just want to talk about the in-depth interviews we did with about 60 people, where we took back to people evidence on the health experience of their area and the opposite area. So if they were in the rich area, we showed them their health profile and the low-income profile and vice versa. And we had conversations with them about what they think were the reasons for this. And at the beginning of these conversations, with every one of the people we interviewed, there was a really obvious divergent response to the initial question about what do you think causes these differences. And the people in the poorer areas disputed the evidence. Without exception, they all challenged the evidence. Whereas the wealthier people accepted the evidence and started immediately talking about causes. There was a sense, in fact, amongst people in the wealthier areas of embarrassment about talking about this and embarrassment about the privilege. the position they thought they were in. So what I want to do is just talk about these people living in disadvantaged areas. And these are some of the examples of how every one of these interviews started with, I don't believe it, that puzzles me, I can't believe them, the data. Okay. So we explored why they didn't believe it. And the first reason they didn't believe it, which won't surprise you, is that they didn't trust the statistics. Okay, the evidence contradicted the facts as they understood them. And this, I think, is a wonderful quote. He wasn't the only person that made this kind of comment, but he just turns public health knowledge on its head. I would think, actually, that they, the rich, weren't as healthy as the poor because of all the spirits they drink and the stuff they eat. I mean, if you eat the basics like we do, I think you're much healthier. I mean, they just make the figures look bad. I don't trust statistics at all. So don't trust statistics. It's quite widespread, I think, that. But the second and much more common reason for rejecting the label had to do with the fact that it was labelling and had to do with the fact that implicit in that there was an inevitability of premature death for them and for their children. And this is another typical example. You always choose the ones who are more articulate, perhaps. But this notion that Salford, the place where this person lives, is generally seen to be a dump, and therefore the people in it are outcasts. There's pollution. Other than that, it's attitudes. They're making out that it's all like scum and they're all dying. It doesn't make sense. So it's a real rejection of the kind of labelling and stigmatisation that goes on in much of public health, geographical information system mapping, etc. But despite the fact that at the beginning of the conversation there was this rejection, there was a challenging of the statistics, there was a challenging of the labelling, as these conversations moved on, people did provide very vivid accounts of the lived experience of inequality. So they weren't denying their experiences. They were holding very contradictory accounts, perspectives, quite happily as we went through this conversation. And in these stories of the experience of inequality, there were embedded in them explanations for the relationship between living in this place and having poor health experience. This is, again, another example of somebody who, without question, made the link between this place and my ill health. I'm a strong person. I can deal with a lot of things, but this particular place and living in this area has made me ill. At the end of the day, you've got to feel happy in the place you're living in because that's your source. It's where you're based. I can't deal with it. So this woman was very clearly at the beginning saying, I don't believe these statistics. Okay. So it's not that they're denying the relationship at all. But why do they think the place is affecting their health? How do they explain the problems? Well, again, without exception, in the interviews with people living in poor areas, what was emphasized above everything else was indirect mechanisms. So this relationship between poor places and poor health for these people was mediated by, in particular, stress. There was a very clear stress discourse in these stories. And one, not the only one, but one of the sources of stress that people talked about was social comparisons. What it felt like to be me living in this place, seeing these other people living in different places. And again, here's a quote. It's only obvious that we would not feel health-wise as someone would who has all the comforts and luxuries around them. You know, they go on holidays 3 times a year, whereas we can't afford to go on one holiday. So that's the difference. Their outlook on life is more relaxed and at ease and comfortable, whereas we are struggling day to day with pressures and to keep up with things. So there was no denial of this relationship. There was a very clear sense that this relationship between poor places and poor health was mediated by indirect mechanisms. But there was also talk about protective factors, the way in which people could protect themselves, could do something about this. And here, the most prominent theme was about the individual's strength of character, the individual's ability to overcome these difficulties. And this is, again, these are typical quotes. There are many of these kinds of quotes. The first thing you do when you get up is see the graffiti, the vandalism, and it doesn't help. But at the end of the day, if you let it get to you, it just causes you ill health. It's how the individual deals with it all. If you let it get you down, you're going to have the health problems. So a very rational line of argument developing here from these accounts. But at the same time, there was absolutely no lack of understanding about the wider structural determinants. They were not kidding themselves about what the circumstances they were living in, how the circumstances they were living in were affecting their health. And this woman makes this very interesting distinction between your own worries and outside worries. So she says, I mean, everybody has a bit of worry, but it's our own worries brought on by ourselves. But outside worries that you haven't got any influence on changing, that has a bigger effect on you, I think. You can't sit down and think, well, I've got this problem and how can I solve it? Because you can't solve it. And it's outside your house. It's an outside influence that you can't control, you can't change it, you haven't the power to change it, and it takes over your life. Okay, so in summary, like a lot of research, if you present people with a picture of inequality where they're on the unequal end, they're on the bad end, they will reject that. And there's a lot of research that shows that. But when they talk about the experience of living in places which represent major hazards to health, they recognise that. There's absolutely no denial of that. But the theories they have to explain it emphasise indirect mechanisms. And the most important protective factors are to be found within oneself. They're the strength of character, the way in which you yourself can overcome this. So what you can do from that kind of account is think about, so what purpose are these theories serving? And I think this is the key to thinking about how lay theories are relevant to health inequality action. The first thing to recognise is that far from being primitive leftovers of a bygone age, these theories are very complex. They're multifactorial. They recognise life course influences. In fact, they are very similar to the current academic theories about the causes of health inequalities. Different language. They're not medicalised. They don't use the same language. They've not picked it up from reading the BMJ, etc. It's been drawn out of their experience. But, as I said at the beginning, what the core purpose of these theories is to assign meaning to an experience. And the experience is an experience of inequality, an experience of being at the bottom of a social gradient. And because of that, because that's the experience that's trying to be explained, understood, rationalised, these theories, I would argue, are doing three things. And they're really important in doing that. The first thing they do is allow people to reconstruct their moral worth in a situation where their moral worth is being undermined. And that idea is very common in the literature around chronic illness. People who experience chronic illness, one of the first things they do narratively in making sense of that is to try and explain why it's them with a moral purpose, to give themselves back moral status. We live in a society where to be ill is morally suspect. That's why we've got now, at the moment, the disability, the incapacity allowance being challenged. It's not, you can't be chronically unwell without being suspect morally. So these theories allow people to reconstruct a morally acceptable position for themselves. And they do that at the individual level, but also at the collective level. So they have shared morally reconstructed positions. So that's the first thing they do. And it's really important, and we all do it when challenged around health and illness. The second thing they do is that they reassert the possibility for individual control in a situation where there is recognition that the scope for that control is very limited. And that, I believe, is where the emphasis on indirect mechanisms is located. And it's also where the emphasis on strength of character comes from. It's the little worries inside ourselves and those worries outside ourselves that we can't do anything about. So we focus on the little worries and on the personal capacities that allow us to control those. But they also are constructed in a way that allow people to reconcile the need for control with a recognition of the wider determinants. So they're a really important part of being a socially acceptable human being, or of being socially acceptable community of people living in. These theories, these shared narratives, provide a way of repositioning these communities of people in a society. And I kind of thought about this when I was putting the presentation together. So there's a kind of so what, you know, that's really interesting, so what, or maybe some of you are thinking what a load of, you know, but. And I thought, well, what the next step might be to think about an audit framework that would come from that. If you were thinking about policy and practice for health inequalities and you wanted to take lay theories seriously, then what questions might you ask of your policy? And I these are just off the top of my head. They may seem ridiculous, but maybe it's a starting point to just think about it. And it seems to me the first question that should be asked is, does this policy, does this practice recognise the moral nature of health inequalities? And I would argue, in England, that most of the policies don't. They are a direct challenge to people's moral status. And for New Deal for Communities, for example, our big books way of regenerating areas, people had to go through a postcode beauty contest to get the money. They had to demonstrate how terrible their areas were in order to get at the top of the top 20, 50 neighbourhoods that were going to get the money. So not only do they not recognise the moral nature, they totally undermine that idea. And although in our Office of the Deputy Prime Minister there is some recognition of the fact that they did that and that might not have been right, they still do it in lots of other ways. So that's the question. Is this policy practice recognising the moral nature of health inequalities? Is it seeking ways to avoid increasing the stigma of inequality? How can we do that? Is it giving people real control over the design, delivery and evaluation of interventions? Real control, not just letting the residents chair the neighbourhood panel, but letting them have control over what happens. So all of that, I think, is it taking lay knowledge and expertise seriously and responding to it? Not blindly, okay, what do you want? Right, we'll do it. But in a serious dialogue of equal but different. So, is lay knowledge taken seriously? My third area. Well, no. Although I say, well, not in England. Maybe in Scotland. You may have cracked it. So I just wanted to think about what some of the work I've done on what's getting in the way. And I don't expect you to read this, but I have to put it up. That's what's getting in the way, okay? And you're absolutely not supposed to read it. But the point is that it's really messy what's getting in the way. And the reason for putting that up is to kind of give you a sense of the complexity of the things that are getting in the way and the scale of the things that are getting in the way, okay? And what this model is trying to do is highlight the barriers to community engagement. And community engagement is the rhetoric in England for listening to local people, taking lay knowledge seriously, engaging with the community. And the model focuses on two domains of barriers. It looks at barriers in public sector organisations and professions, and it looks at barriers in local communities, okay? And I'll say a little bit about both. Public sector barriers, I should just say, I am a bit ignorant about health policy in Scotland, but we won't have public sector organisations in England for very much longer. But while we've got them, it might be worth thinking about how we address the barriers, because chances are that the barriers will be transferred to whatever the mixed economy of healthcare delivery organisations we have. So the first, and the one that gets most attention, is that there is a lack of skills and competencies for engagement. So if you do a quick skim of continuing professional development, there's loads of courses and seminars on how to increase your skills and competencies in community engagement or public involvement or whatever. So that gets most attention. It is, of course, the least important. The second, and probably one of the most important, is issues around the culture of our public sector professions and our organisations. And in particular, there's a major problem with risk aversion. I mean, probably many of you have filled in the 40-page form to get the 100 quid for the community group, or tried to get the 20-page final report out of the community group after they've spent the 100 quid. And that's still going on. I mean, the New Deal can't spend its money because it's so hard, really, to give money away. And there's lots of problems there. There's problems around different understandings about what health is about, etc., but major problems. And then there are problems in the wider system, really. And certainly, if you look at the evaluations of things like health action zones, healthy living centres, Sure Start, one of the biggest problems is that these initiatives are set up to be genuine attempts to engage the community in the long term in social change. But by the way, 6 months downstream, can we have a quick win? Yeah, okay, do something on smoking cessation, you know, or whatever. And it, of course, that breaks the contract with the community, who've been told, you can set the agenda, but meanwhile, we're going to do all these things over here while you're setting the agenda. So the quick win is a profoundly problematic, and of course comes out of the whole political system. And then, I think I'm wrong here. I don't think there is a lack of clarity about purpose. I think actually I do find that there is a lot of clarity about purpose, and community engagement in many of our English public health initiatives is a delivery mechanism. It's not an end in itself. It's not something we value because we believe in it. It's a way of delivering whatever it is we are supposed to be delivering. And that is a fundamental problem for it. So just a bit about the public sector. And paternalism is still a problem in the public sector. This is just an example of from some work we've been doing where we were looking at initiatives that were building community capacity to engage. And what underpinning this, these initiatives, there was an assumption that poor people have to learn to participate, that professional experts can teach poor people how to participate, and because it's professionals doing it, of course, they have positional power. They can dictate the terms on which the learning is done. So these processes, with the best will in the world, are reinforcing dependency and reinforcing inequalities of power. So let's just look at the capacity of local people. What research has shown us is that there absolutely are barriers in the way of local people, lay people, working in partnership with professionals around health inequalities. No doubt about it. But those barriers are not a lack of innate capacity. They don't need to learn to participate. And they're not a lack of knowledge. They've got a lot of knowledge. This is the joke. Fish head soup. I was going to draw it, but I couldn't do. In fact, the joke comes from Glasgow in the 1930s, during the Depression. And I know David and Sue will know it, because I think one of you gave it me, actually. And the ladies in Twinset and Pearls, in England they're called the Women's Institute. I won't even attempt a Glaswegian accent. But they used to do classes teaching people how to cook nutritious meals on very low incomes. In fact, we've reintroduced it in our new white paper here in England. And one of these lessons was about cod's head soup, fish head soup, which is apparently a very nutritious soup. So at the end of the lesson, the lady who was doing the teaching said to the women, are there any questions? And there was a woman at the back who said, I've just got one question. While we're eating the cod's head, who's eating the cod? Which I think is a wonderful illustration, really, of the fact that this is not about lack of knowledge, it's not about lack of nous, it's not about lack of political understanding. So what are the core barriers here to lay people engaging? And there's a bit of a puzzle, really, although I think it's a simple puzzle to answer. In the work I've done, when you talk to people living in poor circumstances, they will generally say that they will act collectively to change the circumstances, but only if they believe that there are important and relevant issues to act on, and only if collective action would be effective. The surveys in all our poor areas with marginalized groups show that there are many relevant and important concerns. There's no lack of issues that are relevant to the groups. But there are relatively few people willing to engage to try and change it. So there's only one thing left there in terms of this rationale, which is that people don't believe that collective action will be effective. And unlike professionals, I think that this is because people are acting on the evidence. And in a couple of studies we've done, we talked to people about their history of being engaged, of participating, going back actually to the 1950s through regeneration, waves of regeneration. And we identified these three groups. It's a bit like market research, actually, isn't it? But there were the engagers, a very small group of people. But for these people, the experience of being engaged in changing circumstances in the place where they lived had transformed their lives. They'd got skills, they'd got into higher education, they'd got jobs. They were on a completely different trajectory than they had been before. There was a slightly bigger group who we call the disillusioned, for whom the experience of being engaged had had a significant impact on their lives. And I think this is one of the most neglected things, that actually, if we do engagement wrong, we damage people. And in this research, and research in Australia, there are instances of people with serious enduring mental health problems which were triggered by being involved on, for example, residence groups, where the thing went pear-shaped and an individual is left to carry all the anger of the community because it's gone pear-shaped. So I think we need to recognise that there are iatrogenic consequences of engagement. It's not a good always. And then there's the biggest group of all, who are the reluctant. And these are people who have never been engaged in action locally to change things. They see no evidence of action ever having changed anything, and so they don't see why they should be engaged. Okay. So I believe that for public health and for people who are really serious about working to reduce health inequalities, there's a central paradox. On the one hand, I do accept that there is widespread and really genuine commitment in the public sector to take lay knowledge seriously and to engage more equally with lay people in decision making. I think it's widespread and I think it's genuine. People might actually be a little illiterate about what it means, but it shouldn't negate the fact that it's a genuine commitment. I believe that there's a widespread capacity for engagement in even the most excluded and disadvantaged groups. But people learn from experience, not just their experience. I think there's a history to this. I think the experience of engagement, not working and damaging people, is carried over generations. So when we did the work in Salford, young people now knew that their grandfathers and grandmothers who were involved in the 1950s and 60s slum clearance had had a terrible time. So they were not going to get involved in New Deal for communities. So these stories, they pass through generations. And people learn. They're acting on the evidence. They're not going to get engaged. So to make this happen, there is a need for profound cultural and structural changes to release community and organisational capacity. The agenda here isn't building it on either the public sector, in professions or communities. The agenda is not to build capacity, it's to release capacity for more effective engagement. And one of the problems in the public sector, I think, is that we're almost now indoctrinated not to think about barriers. We have to think positive. You've got to think positive. You've got to think about assets, community assets. You've got to think about all our strengths. And I believe that that's a waste of time unless you address the barriers. There's a management guru called Llewellyn, I think, who talks about the problems. If you don't reduce the barriers and you put processes in place to change things, then you'll just get an equal resistance coming back if you don't reduce the barriers. And I think that's what you can see around community engagement in many places in England. So what's to be done? I think probably the most important thing is I am passionate about this, but I also don't think taking lay knowledge seriously is the silver bullet. Like all other areas, there isn't a silver bullet, but it's a really critical piece of the jigsaw. But we need to remember that engagement can damage people if it's not done well. So if it's not going to be done well, we shouldn't do it. So the challenge, as I said, is to release capacity, not to build it. We have to recognise and reduce the barriers, and we really have to work on recognising the barriers. And power has to be seen to be redistributed, and engagement has to be seen to have real impacts if it's going to begin to work. I think the starting point is to take this knowledge seriously. And to do that, I think there's a kind of nugget in here which is really the heart of the matter. The first thing is to recognise that involving people in decisions is not about involving them in how their money gets spent. It might eventually be conversations about how money gets spent, how resources get distributed, but that's not the bottom line. It is about involving people in enduring processes, long-term processes, to allow them to have a real say in how life is to be lived. And I come back to where I started, really. So this struggle, and it is a struggle, and you have to recognise it's a struggle because it's about redistributing power, is a struggle over meaning, not a struggle over resources. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And a challenging session. I think it was a good session entirely in keeping with the Glasgow Centre itself, which has been set up to ask difficult questions and to challenge the status quo. We've got time for some discussion, so do people want to put their hands up and get the discussion going from?
Can I ask, who, Colin, was the articulation of the traditional risk factors such as smoking, too much alcohol, wrong food, and perceptions of blame?
In the the people in the higher income areas were more comfortable with those
recommendations.
Well, they kind of flitted over it. I mean, they did mention smoking and diet, but it wasn't a preoccupation. It was much more dominant in the higher income areas. An important kind of methodological issue is they knew we were talking about place. So, and what we know but the high-income areas people did as well, you know. So we were interested in the relationship between place and health. And that would structure the response, inevitably that would structure the response. So unlike other research where place hasn't figured at all in people's discourse, people's accounts, it did figure here. But it's still interesting that the people in the high-income areas didn't talk about place. They talked about individual behaviours. They talked about diet and smoking and exercise. Whereas the people living in these poor places did talk about. So the individual behaviour discourse was not absent from any of the accounts. It's what was most common.
I was just going to ask, inevitably community activists or people from the community that are going to get involved in community engagement quite often are not going to be working because they don't have more time to get involved in these things. So how does that fit into everything? You will inevitably find with a lot of community activists for whatever reason will not be working if they move on.
Well, that's true, but a lot of people who aren't action aren't active are also not working.
Yeah, so, sure. I just wanted to know.
Well, it is a key issue, isn't it? I think there's been some work on what proportion of the resident chairs of New Deal for communities are without paid employment, and it's not everybody. There are a fair number who are have some paid employment, but inevitably these are areas with very high levels of unemployment. But in the high income areas, there were people they weren't involved in public sector organisations who were trying to transform their place because they didn't need to transform their place. These were not places which were regularly generated. But those people with employment were engaged in all sorts of other activities, environmental activities, Women's Institute, etc. So I mean it's clearly an issue. But I think it's very difficult to say to say exactly what the nature of the issue is. It seems to me that if it was a time issue, then you would have a lot more people involved and engaged because there are a lot more people without jobs.
Sometimes it could end up being a negative thing for people if they're given a spend lots of time there and burn out, and that can then end up being a negative experience.
Well, yes, I don't think they burn out because they have lots of time. I think they burn out because they're not given support. I mean, in one of the projects, it's called SAR, the Salford Action Research Project, which was funded by the Health Development Agency, they mistakenly signed a contract which gave us enormous freedom over how we spent our money. So they couldn't stop us from paying for some very expensive organisational development gurus to come in and work with the community groups, not with the public sector organisations who had their own expensive gurus. And they complained actually about how much we were spending on the organisational gurus for the community group. But we had no burnout in that group, and they were very active, but they had a lot of support. So I think burnout is about how people who are activists get isolated. They get left to carry the can by the public sector agencies. When things go wrong, there's not thinking through how you can support people to do that, rather than it being a simple issue of how much time people put in.
I was interested to see, could you say a little bit more about your building and releasing capacity? Because there is so much discussion about buildings. Could you just expand a little bit more about your thinking on what you mean by release capacity?
Well, I think what I'm saying is that all the work, both research and development work I've done with community groups, health service users, social care users, and with professional groups, I'm absolutely clear that there is not a lack of skills, knowledge, or competences for engaging. The problem is there are all these barriers in the way of people having the kinds of conversations and possibility they need, really, of listening to what people are saying. So, you know, you have the professional going in, and they've quit win business, you know, in Health Action Zone, which Ken Judge will know more about, but it's a story that's repeated in the Healthy Living Centres and in Sure Start, which is that people go into these initiatives as professionals because they're so passionate about letting users and the community have a say, and then they're required to deliver something very, very quickly. So that immediately gets in the way of a dialogue that says, okay, what is the agenda here? How do we set the agenda? So I'm not saying there won't be issues of skills and knowledge and competence. It's just that those are absolutely not the first thing we should be doing. It sets up the problem in the wrong way to talk about building, because I think we could make much more progress if we address the barriers, reduce the barriers, allow people to begin to recognise the skills, knowledge and competence they have that's relevant, and then maybe we'll get a better sense of where the gaps are, and, you know, rather than this kind of deluge of community engagement skills seminars, and, which we've got at the moment in England, we may not have.
At the start of your work, you spoke about the interviewees having quite an almost individualistic viewpoint, stating strength of character, being aware of wider issues of individual strength of character, survival, and what saw you through. And even as the interviews progressed, one of the prerequisites for engagement was evidence that collective action was going to be effective. One of the things that's been looked at again in Scotland just now, the community engagement front, community regeneration, is a reappraisal of individual action, whether through a transformation, be it social, or to the community, or mortality. I'm wondering what you want to say there about the sort of efficacy or appropriateness of individual action as opposed to collective action.
Another strand of this work was looking at what we called shared narratives in place. And it seems to me that one of the problems with some of our most disadvantaged places is that the kinds of social processes that are underway are undermining the development of a shared narrative about us in this place. Yes. So, for example, in Salford, in the second, we did a number of rounds of interviews. In the second round of interviews, people talked about how the fear of crime was a big issue in this. So they talked about the steps they went through to protect themselves from crime, which inevitably individualised their lives. It started to close off relationships with other people. They also talked about one of the strategies people adopt in this moral discourse is to distance themselves from the people who are not moral and me or us who are. So there's some very fine cartographies of space being narrated. And what we argue is that those processes are undermining people developing a shared narrative about this place, what it's like to live here, the neighbours, the friends, da da. And I think to the extent that the social entrepreneur programmes contribute even more to that, then it's a negative thing. But some of the social entrepreneur initiatives I've seen, whilst they're about individual entrepreneurs beginning it, their aim is to generate collective action in some way. So it seems to me that it depends, you know, like all of these initiatives, there's a multitude of different models, isn't there, for social entrepreneurs. And in one of our areas, for example, the social entrepreneur had been supported to set up a community garden and then a cafe, which had inevitably become a space where people began to rebuild shared narratives about the place and work together. So I think for me, the judgment about the contribution of the social entrepreneur movement is the extent to which it has a collective aspiration.
Ken.
Hi, Jenny. I'm one of these people who's heard some of this before, and I've always gotten something new out of it, so thank you very much for that. Very interesting and very important. But I'm struggling with the macro implications of it, because you try to locate what you told us tonight in the context of health inequalities policy. So I wonder, what for you are the main implications of this long stream of research, the policy today in relation to health inequalities policy? What, in terms of policy in England, would you change? And what would be the consequences of making those changes?
Well, I think the fundamental problem with what I would change is the political system. Because of the nature of Westminster politics, what you need here is a longer time frame, and you need more secure, not more bigger funding, but more secure funding for these initiatives to evolve different relationships between the public provision, whoever's providing it, and the people who they are serving, whether that's housing and education, whatever. And those relationships need the circumstances in which those relationships can develop over time, and power be shifted. So it is a democratic renewal agenda, I think, but that is undermined by the way in which policy gets done, really. So, I think New Deal for Communities, in theory, if you read the documentation, health action zones, in theory, if you read the documentation, had the potential to address this issue of the social relationships of knowledge, and therefore the social relationships of action. But they didn't get a chance to do it because of all the political pressures. So it's not what policies, it's how you do policy. And the how you do policy seems to me to be a political issue, really. So I think that's a major problem. But I still think locally there is the ability for local government, for local health agencies, senior managers to do things. There's always the window of opportunity, isn't there? There's the room for manoeuvre, even within this big system. To allow people to take this knowledge and action and stuff seriously. And in my experience, they don't do it. We tried with that messy model. We tried to implement that model in primary care trusts, regional development agencies, local authorities, and an acute trust. And the underpinning that model is the idea that you have to have in a room, it's a kind of whole system. You have to have in the room the whole system, and you have to Engage in a dialogue where you have no simple answers. There's no questions which can be answered yes, no. You're not looking for solutions. You're trying to identify barriers. But that's really hard to get them to do that. And the first people to stop it were the chief execs and the chairs of the boards, because it was a really threatening process. So there's kind of, there is some micro stuff which will help, as well as the, I mean, I'm probably waffling, but it, you know, it seems to me that that's that it's those two, that, you know, you do need some of this cultural change stuff to go on at the level of public sector organisations. But the main problem is that policy doesn't get a chance to.
Started off by talking about stories. Stories imply a very individualistic approach. And I was wondering how that's actually going to work out in terms of collective thing. But one of the things that you followed on, which I thought was very interesting, you talked about this experience of slum clearance in Salford. You seem to be suggesting that there was another narrative going round, which wasn't just based on a set of individuals, but individuals with things in common. And that Salford, you seem to imply that neighbourhoods in Salford were beginning to be a little bit reluctant about these things. And I wondered if the threefold thing which you ended up about, people being engaged or disillusioned or reluctant, can be applied on a geographical area within Salford. Have you got areas in Salford where there are engaged areas or disillusioned areas or reluctant areas? So if you can take that approach, and that is really valuable in terms of what we're doing in Glasgow, in terms of community planning, which does tend to be saying we're going to try the same approach in every single area and hopefully get the same kind of results. Can you fine-tune your approach that way to geographical areas?
I'm not sure you could do it to geographical areas, because I think you would find people with these different perspectives in every area. You might find more or less of them. I mean, we did that work in Lancaster as well. We still found these three different, broadly three different groups. I mean, there's some people, as always, you know, on the margins. This is very true. But I think that the one of the important issues is the is actually for urban renewal to take account of the history of places in a more sophisticated way than they have in the past. Really. And it, I think there's lots of different aspects to that. But this kind of notion that the stories people tell today are built on the stories that they have heard from families and friends and passed through the generations is really important, I think. So that those areas where I have done any work at all, which have had waves of regeneration, you can see the strands in the stories about what happened when they did this, when they knocked that down, when they redid those houses over there. You know, I mean, I think it's a very telling indictment of urban policy that we're regenerating places. These places have had many different waves, and that's captured in people's narratives. So maybe it would be useful to do a bit of historical research as well as all the other kind of preparatory work that goes on to develop policies for urbanists, to get a sense of what people's experience has been historically.
You've talked a lot about lay theories of health and how they affect our understanding of the wider determinants of health. I was wondering if you've explored the concept of health inequalities from a lay perspective and what the range of views are, particularly in high and low income areas, whether the actual issue of inequalities and the very unequal distribution of health, whether lay theories have any insight to give us on how people actually
well, that's what that was about. I mean, they didn't talk about it in terms of inequality. So that wasn't part of. But those theories were based on presenting people with evidence about the differences between rich people and poor people. And
so yes.
Well, that's what they. What I'm saying. The first thing they did was deny the fact that there were inequalities. That was the first thing they did. The people who were in the worst health, living in the worst places, denied those differences. But that was only an initial response. As the conversations went on, they elaborated these reasons for the differences, which tended to be indirect mechanisms linked to living in poor places, made it the case that we people living in these places would have worse health than those people. So those were their explanations were, their theories of inequalities were psychosocial theories, indirect stress-related psychosocial theories, and their protective factors were also psychosocial. It was about resilience and individual strength of character. No, because what they're saying is that poor people have more stress. You know, so if poor people have more stress, then their health will be worse than rich people. Well, that would explain the pattern.
I agree with you, Jenny, that dialogue is potentially threatening when you have power, because that's one of the things that you've been saying. And therefore, those of us that have some responsibilities for making the changes have got to think about what the impact of your research is on us, as much as what it means for more communities. And certainly, the history of community development in this country, for those of us that are going to get long enough in the tooth to remember it, would suggest that once it began to become successful, we found that the resources for it were then being reduced, and it became a co-opted process. And now everybody talks about community development, but when it started, it actually was about trying to achieve more dialogue. Having said all that, in Glasgow, we are actually in the middle of an experiment. We have restructured our health service to create a completely, hopefully, a new environment by which we take more responsibility for inequalities and embed it much more systematically into all our work than we've done in the past. So my question to you is actually in relation to your policy and practice audit framework, and I accept some of those aspects that we would have to look at. What would success look like?
What would success look like?
Yes.
Well, who would define it, I think I would say to you.
Well, from your perspective.
Well, I think success would look like not having professional notions of what success would look like, and I can't say what that would be. You know, I mean, in one of the areas where we worked, success looked like having no more dog dirt on the streets, and that was really important to people, and when they got no more dog dirt on the street, they felt really pleased with their collective action, and, you know, and they kind of went home and didn't engage for a while, or didn't engage at all. So, I think that success would look like more outcomes that looked odd to professionals. But I do think that the thing about, I mean, you know, from a community development point of view, the point about it is that it is surprising, really, what people want, sometimes how modest their wishes, their wish list is as well, actually. So, but I think success, you could begin to define success in terms of different kinds of relationships between maybe we wouldn't have professionals in the same way as we have had for the last 50 years. I mean, you know, it's a minute blip on a kind of a historical trajectory, isn't it? The notion of the professional with a particular codified form of knowledge. But that would be quite a lot further on. But certainly relationships between professionals and service users or lay people would change, I think. But how they would change. I mean, you could talk about power issues, about control, about who defines agendas, all those kinds of things, but they seem all, they're quite short-termy, aren't they? It's really what longer-term success would look like. And I do think that, well, I mean, it's very idealistic, but I think success would also look like a much more vital, dynamic, political, public sphere. You know, that this wouldn't be just about regenerating that place. It would be more generally about going back to a situation where, let me say, in Salford, I did some historical work in Salford looking at the minutes of Manchester Council and Salford Council, okay? And there was this wonderful little quote in the minutes of a meeting where one of the Manchester councillors was telling another Manchester councillor, for God's sake, don't go to Salford because they have public meetings at the drop of a hat. Now, Salford is generally considered now a desert. You know, there's no public meeting. If you have a public meeting, nobody turns up for a public meeting. So 100 years ago, they were out on the streets at the slightest thing in Salford, and now there's no public sphere in Salford. Political activity is at a minimum. So I can imagine in Salford, success would look like councillors being frightened that there might be a public meeting if they put a foot wrong. You know, so more activity, more dynamism about the public in the public sphere. But I am walking. I'm getting tired, actually. So.
One, I think probably two more questions, and then we'll call the session to a close.
I'd be interested to find out what childcare issues were raised as part of it, and also what issues were raised around professionals who were always looking in boxes. And, you know, we talk about health inequalities, but they're talking about crime and housing, and as a health professional, we're not responsible for that, and that's the boxes.
The childcare came up in, but we didn't, I mean, you know, these conversations were not at that kind of level where people, we went where people took us, really. And that tended to be about living in, what it was like living in this place, at this time, really. So there were people who commented on the lack of facilities, and there were bits of narratives about people who desperately would like to get a paid job but couldn't because of maybe the lack of childcare. But it was not dominant in these interview transcripts. In terms of professionals, I mean, the people living in a rich area didn't mention services. You know, it kind of wasn't relevant for them. They didn't talk about the council or the health service or anything. You know, they also talked in a very distant way about how terrible it was that people had these health experiences. So it was kind of one removed from them. And those interviews were much shorter. You know, it was really hard to get them to talk for more than about half an hour. Whereas the interviews with people in the disadvantaged areas were an hour and a half, 2 hours, some of them were 4 hours. So there was a very big qualitative difference about the nature of the accounts, you know. In the low-income area narratives, there were, I don't know, we haven't done the analysis in that way, but the local councils didn't come off very well. And our understanding of that, and the health authority was hardly mentioned, and there was a health authority at the time rather than a primary care trust, which we're going back to health authorities now, so it'll be all right if people haven't caught up with that. So the health authority wasn't kind of mentioned, but the council, they were vitriolic about the council. You know. And I mean, my kind of take on that is that it wasn't that the council was a lot worse than the health sector. It was the council was so much more central to people's lives than the health sector. So professionals didn't come out of these accounts very well at all. You know. They were either irrelevant to people's lives or they were a significant disbenefit in their lives. Really. But we haven't done a systematic analysis of that.
I think we should probably draw the session to a close. Thank you very much, Jenny, for coming up and sharing your thoughts and views with us. It's been a super session. It's been very stimulating. Many of us in the room have been involved and continue to be involved in community action and in trying to change things. And I think it's been good to have this sort of debate. I mean, I think it's been salutary to hear about the barriers that face everybody in trying to get change, but I think it's also been very stimulating. So thank you very much indeed. There is refreshments outside, but just a note about the next seminar. In keeping with having influential women along to the seminar series, we have Ilona Kickbush is coming to talk to us. And the title is The Global Health Challenge, Why Do We Need Good Governance for Health? And she is talking on February the 14th. The city centre venue has yet to be confirmed, but I think that what Valerie and Richard are sending out emails to everybody about this. But anyway, put the date in your diary, it's the 14th of February. And the drinks and everything outside. Thank you.